A novel about the Holocaust by a blacklisted socialist writer. It's just been published in the U.S. over 60 years after it was written.
Until July of 2023, Maltz's A Tale of One Gender had never been published in the United States. So this is it. So it's a long history for the novel to get here, and it's quite a testament to the things that you lose as a nation when you start blacklisting people. I think Maltz is throughout his career, and many stories about that adds up to a really good example of what we lose when we start blacklisting.
That's Patrick Chura. He wrote the introduction to A Tale of One January and is responsible for its publication by Bloomsbury Press. Then we replay an extended segment of our 2018 interview with Norman Finkelstein about his book Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The novel, A Tale of One January, tells the story of six prisoners who have just escaped from a forced march out of the Auschwitz concentration camp. Based on a true story told by one of the escapees to the writer Albert Maltz, the novel paints a compelling portrait of what it's like to experience sudden freedom after years of horrific confinement and the constant threat of death. Albert Maltz was a committed socialist who wrote for the stage and screen until he was blacklisted in 1947 as one of the Hollywood Ten. A Tale of One January was published in the UK in 1967, but due to the blacklist, was never published in the US until now. Patrick Chura is writing a biography of Albert Maltz and wrote the introduction to A Tale of One January. He's professor of English at the University of Akron and the author of Thoreau the Land Surveyor and Michael Gold, the People's Writer. Patrick Chura, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So this novel, A Tale of One January, based on a true story, it's about a group of six concentration camp survivors who have just escaped a forced march toward the end of the war, I guess 1944, when the Russian front is moving up close to Auschwitz. And it was written in 1962. So tell us about the author, Albert Maltz.
Sure. Actually, January 45 is the setting for this novel. He's quite a story. I'm working on a biography of Albert Maltz. I've got a long way to go, but he gets more interesting by the day. So in 1944, his very acclaimed novel was The Cross in the Arrow. It's about anti-Nazi resistance in Germany itself by German citizens. That was acclaimed to the extent that they printed quickly 150,000 copies for distribution to U.S. servicemen abroad. Also, just a year later in 1945, Maltz worked with Frank Sinatra on a little 10-minute film called The House I Live In. Sinatra starred in the film. Albert Maltz wrote it. It was really written for the single purpose of counteracting a lot of anti-Semitic violence that was going on in New York and Boston in the mid-1940s. And it won in 1945 a special Oscar for its contribution to racial and religious tolerance. So Maltz got an early call out by the Motion Picture Academy. He had moved to Hollywood in 1941. And from 41 on, he was using screenwriting and the money he could earn as a screenwriter to finance his career as a novelist. He said over and over again during his lifetime that his real work that he wanted to be remembered for most was his work as a novelist. So his strategy was to use his film credits, which produced some substantial and interesting films along the way. He was very respected and sought after at the peak of his career as a screenwriter. He was brought up in 1947 in the early Cold War. After World War II ended, the right wing just really started to turn its eyes toward leftism in the United States and call it out. So in 1947, he, along with, well, he was a member of the Hollywood Ten, who were called before a House committee chaired by J. Parnell Thomas and, you know, asked the kind of million-dollar question, right? Are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And the Hollywood 10 banded together, and they decided to fight this committee, not on the grounds of the Fifth Amendment, tending to not incriminate oneself, so to speak. They fought it on the grounds of the First Amendment. Albert Malt said, the American people are going to have to choose between the Bill of Rights and the Thomas Committee. They cannot have both. One or the other must be abolished in the immediate future. And that did not go over well with the Thomas Committee. The six of the Hollywood 10 members were Jewish, and there was quite a bit of anti-Semitism on the Thomas Committee as well, and Albert Maltz knew that. So they were sentenced, given various sentences, but Albert Maltz got a year in prison for contempt of Congress. In 1950-51, he was in the Mill Point Prison in West Virginia. Kind of interesting, his career went through a transition stage when he was convicted of contempt of Congress and sentenced to prison, because he had completed a novel in 1949 called The Journey of Simon McKeever, but it was unclear at first whether the blacklist that all of the Hollywood 10 were subjected to, and many others, obviously, in Hollywood, it was unclear whether that applied to the publishing industry at first. So Maltz got a novel published in 1949. It was excellent and well-received by Little Brown and Company, initially well-received, until 20th Century Fox bought the film rights to it immediately because it really had a lot of potential as a film. And it was announced that it would star Walter Huston and that Fox had bought it. But just weeks later, the backlash against it was so strong from the right wing that Fox canceled the project. So this was the beginning of Maltz feeling the real brunt of the blacklist. He moved to Mexico in the early 1950s. In order to distance himself largely from FBI harassment. And he published another novel in 1957. This novel was an interesting early civil rights novel called A Long Day and a Short Life. But it also had a kind of tortured history. I think it's a great novel, and it's being republished now with my help from Alma Books in the UK. But he sent it to 18 US publishers. It was rejected by everyone until he had to resort to a leftist publisher, International Publishers, to bring it out in the United States. And because of that press's communist ties, they knew it wouldn't be reviewed or noticed. Maltz said that he published it just so his friends could read it. So, you know, a lot of his work was suppressed throughout the 50s. Then, of course, a big event in 1960 was when Frank Sinatra tried to break the blacklist by hiring Maltz and announced that he had hired Maltz to write the film The Execution of Private Slovak. But again, when that came out, even Sinatra, you know, a powerful megastar, could not fight off the right-wing critics who really descended quickly on the whole project, and it became quite a fiasco. And Sinatra had to hire Maltz and then just a couple of weeks later fire him publicly. He caved to the conservative pressure. After that, Maltz felt more blacklisted than ever. It turned out that this was an event that really lengthened his time on the blacklist because it had put his name out in public in a very controversial way and kind of renewed the attacks on him. So just after that is when he meets Dunja Wasserstrom, the Auschwitz survivor in Mexico. And they become friends, and she trusts him enough to tell him her story about her escape from Auschwitz and the details of her background and her time in Auschwitz. And Maltz immediately gets to work on this novel. He finishes it in 62. He takes it to Ingo Preminger, who is the brother of Otto Preminger, a film producer also in Hollywood at that time. Preminger says, "I believe this, and I'm very sure that this would be an excellent film and an excellent novel." So they both work on getting it produced both as a film and a novel. Maltz sends it to his agent. But of course, I think largely as a result of its being just after the Sinatra fiasco, it is an idea that is completely vetoed by both the publishing and filmmaking industry. So he keeps the novel. He makes these extensive interview notes that come out of his long interviews with Dunja Wasserstrom that were conducted in Spanish because Wasserstrom did not speak English at the time. And he files those away with the Authors Guild, and he keeps the novel for a number of years because he feels like, you know, until the late 60s, there might not be anywhere else for it to go. So finally, in 66, he gets a British publisher, Calder and Boyers, to champion the book for the English-speaking world. But until July of this year, until July of 2023, Maltz's A Tale of One Gender had never been published in the United States. So this is its first U.S. publication. So it's a long history for the novel to get here. And it's quite a testament to kind of the things that you lose as a nation when you start blacklisting people. I think Maltz is throughout his career, and many stories about that adds up to a really good example of what we lose when we start blacklisting.
Wow, that is such a powerful story, actually. And you're absolutely right. I mean, reading this book, one realizes that one is in the presence of a real talent. I had never heard of Albert Maltz. And in fact, as I was reading it, I was thinking this should be a screenplay. And I hope it does become a movie. As a matter of fact, it would be an incredible movie. But now let's get to the story. In fact, you say in the introduction that it pretty closely follows the events that Dunja Wasserstrom recounted. But there is some change in the characters. Correct. Specifically, none of the characters are Jewish.
Oh, one is.
Lini. So there are two women and four men. Tell us about these characters, and also, why did he de-emphasize the Jewishness?
Yeah, that's a really good question and a complex one. And I think it has many answers and many possibilities, but it's certainly thought-provoking. Correct. Dunja Wasserstrom was a Ukrainian Jew born in Zhytomyr. She spent her childhood in the Ukraine and her adolescence in Poland. Eventually, she moved to France and sort of adopted France as her nationality. She married there. When the war broke out, she was an anti-Nazi resistor along with her husband. So that is how she ends up in Auschwitz. So when she tells her story to Maltz, though, she's very clear about her background, and she's very trusting of Maltz and friendly with him in order to share this, because she did not share the story with just anyone. Actually, she hadn't made it public until later, and I think we'll get into that. But I'll go back to Dunja Wasserstrom. But there's Lini, who's a Dutch Jew born in Berlin but moved to Amsterdam. In the novel, there's Jurek, who's a Polish Jew, or a Polish resistor. He's not Jewish. None of the men are Jewish. Otto is from Austria, a socialist in Auschwitz for his socialist communist ties. Jurek is in Auschwitz as an anti-Nazi resistor. Norbert is German, but he had been an anti-Nazi resistor too, and that's how he ends up in Auschwitz. And Andrei is a Russian soldier who was sent to Auschwitz because he was captured and escaped. He said that it was sort of a point of honor that he needed to at least attempt to escape and not accept his incarceration. And for that, he was sent to Auschwitz. So quite a mixture of characters. In the novel, they are all of different nationalities, and only one of them is Jewish, and that's Lini. So why did Maltz change Dunja Wasserstrom, kind of deracinating her to some extent? She's portrayed as Claire, blonde-haired, blue-eyed. Dunja Wasserstrom was a dark-haired Ukrainian Jew from Zhytomyr, as I said. There could be several reasons. One is he's a novelist, and he's looking to make a universal statement, and he's got a collection of characters here who are plausible as all six from different places and different nationalities. And I think he decided to go with that and emphasize that. It's a complex decision, though. Dunja Wasserstrom did not disapprove of that. She remained friends with Maltz after the novel was published, and they have exchanges of letters that show that she didn't, you know, resist that change personally. But for a novelist to make that change raises the question of why the Jewishness of the central character is de-emphasized and sort of eliminated from the text. Maltz had a habit of kind of internationalizing his idea of what the anti-fascist struggle should be. I think he had made a decision early in his career that the battle against fascism was not just a Jewish story. So there's that part of his character. His, you know, mission was to show with a lot of clarity, you know, how repressive regimes operated. And I think that was job number one for him. And anti-Jewish suffering and featuring anti-Jewish suffering was kind of a secondary priority. The danger, though, is, of course, I mean, to make it universal, I've talked about this with my students. I'm teaching a course in Jewish American literature this semester, and I have some excellent students, and we've had some good discussions about this issue. But there's a danger in sort of erasing some Jewishness in characters and erasing Jewishness in characters in order to make your story universal. You know, it could cut both ways, because it could suggest that to make it universal, one of the things that has to be sacrificed is Jewishness, which is a complex and potentially harmful kind of message as well.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Patrick Tschura, who wrote the introduction to the long-suppressed Holocaust novel by Albert Maltz, A Tale of One January. This is interesting because I think it also resonates with, I think, some of the controversies today with, you know, a privileging of identity politics over class politics. One could argue, in fact, that that has been detrimental to the left. It's given an opening to the right because it has in some way made some people in the white working class feel like nobody's paying attention to them. I mean, you know, when you talk about income inequality, there are plenty of poor white people, but it's always cast in terms of identity politics, of minority populations, and not that it is actually part of the relationship under capitalism.
Exactly. And, you know, Maltz, you know, his socialist leanings and his leftist philosophy certainly emphasized class first as this divider created by capitalism. And I think also in his life, he had early in his life experienced anti-Semitism and felt it. And he said it made him sensitive from his early childhood, sensitive to the whole issue of injustice. And I think there could have been some really deep psychological impulses in him to again, downplay the Jewish suffering in favor of universal suffering. I think, you know, when he wrote The Cross and the Arrow in 44, there's no Jewish character in the anti-German resistance. There are certainly very clear references to what's going on and what's happening to Jews, but he focuses on how Germans were victims. Germans themselves and the German people were victims too of Hitlerism and fascism and Nazism. So that was a choice to focus on that aspect of it. It worked out well in The Cross and the Arrow. But, you know, in this story, we end up with six people from six different places and six different nationalities, which is in itself a kind of anti-racist message. And, you know, the fact that they so quickly coalesce around each other and become a kind of a human brotherhood, a human grouping of people who care about each other and take care of each other, even though it isn't completely idealized. You know, there are tensions in the group, but he wants to make them a collective. And so the sort of metaphorical feature that they're all from different places works in the novel. Yeah, and Maltz is aware that, you know, 85% of the 85% of the prisoners in Auschwitz were Jewish, and 90% of those killed were Jewish in Auschwitz. He's aware of that, but this is a diverse group.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit just about the story, the situation. We have the two women who are from Auschwitz. They're on a forced march, and they manage to escape. And another contingent then, containing the men, come to the place where they're in hiding, and those men also hide, and this is how they discover each other. And they find a hideout where there is a sympathetic farmer who mostly stays out of the picture, who helps them. So just give us the broad outlines of where they are.
Yeah, they're in the countryside, not far, probably about 14, 15 kilometers from Auschwitz. They didn't really know where they were going. They find an abandoned factory, and they Jurek, who speaks Polish, goes into a town nearby seeking help. He receives it from Karol, but there are certain, you know, dangers that are all around them as they kind of take up this kind of hiding in the abandoned factory. It's an abandoned brick factory It's very cold all the time. The conditions are very, very difficult still, but they're getting regular food in the form of some soup and some meals from Carol, and some clothing to replace the prison garb that they're wearing, the Auschwitz clothing. They've had the women have had their heads shaved 3 days before the forced march. Claire's feet are frozen. They need to be, you know, massaged back to life by both Lenny and Andrei, the Russian soldier. There's danger, too. They can't make fires. That's part of the agreement they made with Carol, because, you know, they still need to be in hiding. And there could be, you know, dangers all around them. The Germans could find them. They're hoping, they hear in the distance the Russian Katyusha rockets that are approaching. They share information about how the war is going, because some of them haven't heard anything being in Auschwitz. But there's a great amount of suspense as to how long they're going to be able to hold out here and what they should do next. But they also feel this incredible feeling of liberation and great happiness just to be able to do something like take a bucket of cold water and wash and have a small meal and sleep without being roused out of bunks by abusive language every morning. And quickly, though, one of the things that quickly emerges among all of them is erotic desire. The men and the women, Claire, she describes herself as being, quote, dead as a woman. Lenny is in better physical condition slightly than Claire, and she's attracted to Norbert. Norbert's attracted to Lenny. Andre is attracted strongly to Claire. Jurek finds a lover in the Polish town, the farmer's daughter. Otto's left out, and a great amount, and a kind of surprising amount of sexual tension results from that dynamic, that Otto feels left out and also has a weapon, a knife, and at one point even considers using it. So it's interesting, too, looking at the interview notes that Maltz made with Dunja Wasserstrom. When I first read this novel, I was thinking, where is he going with this erotic aspect of this? Because you would not expect that among recently escaped concentration camp inmates. But it's there in the interview notes. It's what Dunja Wasserstrom said. It's not a novelistic invention. It's a part of the story. And Maltz apparently was pretty fascinated with that.
Well, these are all young people, even though they look much older than their age because of what they've been through.
Yeah, and the men are remarking that they haven't seen a woman in a long time at all. You know, so, you know, part of their almost uncontrolled feelings of, you know, becoming human again immediately light on erotic things. And so it becomes a kind of love story, too, between Lenny and Norbert, and Claire and Andre. And I find the Claire and Andre interactions very moving.
Yes. I mean, it's not just sexuality. It's really love and care. And, you know, what is, I think the women also remark on it, on how lucky they are that the men are, you know, for the most part, pretty decent human beings. And they realize what the alternative could have meant. There's a very poignant scene in this novel, A Tale of One January by Albert Maltz. And that is a scene where they finally look in a mirror, a little mirror. Talk about that, what their reaction is and how they deal with, you know, with how much they have physically changed.
Well, that is moving, and it's kind of led up to as a moment. When they realize that, for example, I think with Otto, it's like, I'm 24, but I look 10 years older, and they're just despairing at the ravages of their physical beings that have been, you know, that they've been subjected to. And they realize the youth that they've lost. And I think the most prominent, well, Lenny is, you know, kind of disturbed by what she sees, but Claire just breaks down in tears. And there is a photo. I showed this photo to my students. You know, in the novel, Claire is described as being about 90 pounds when her real weight is something like 130. In the interview notes, she was more like 70 pounds. And I think I don't know why Maltz made that small change, but I think it was. I can speculate on it. We can speculate on it no end. But he did make that change. But there is a photograph of Dunja Wasserstrom, a real photograph of her, 3 weeks after, between 2 and 3 weeks after she was, after the events of this novel took place. It is a haunting and ghastly image of her that I think drives home that message of just how physically decimated and devastated she was as a human body. So that photo, along with this moment when she breaks down in tears at the possibility of a mirror, I agree, it's powerful. But not only she, but the other characters recognize too what the prison camp has done to them, even though some of them too, this is also breaking sometimes with, you know, kind of expectations. Norbert and Otto had privileges in Auschwitz. They're German speakers who'd become, you know, capos, kind of leaders of kind of intermediaries between the Nazi bosses and the camp inmates. And so they had been able to, quote, organize on the black market certain privileges, certain foods. For example, it's Otto that has some sugar cubes, and Otto who had been starved somewhat, but he'd gotten more food than the other inmates. So they're at various stages of, bad health and physical decimation. But it's Claire who is the worst, especially because she's had typhus twice.
And she is a stand-in for Dunja Wasserstrom. Yeah.
Yes.
So you said you're working on a biography of Albert Maltz. How did you get involved in this story?
To be honest, I wrote a biography of another leftist writer named Michael Gold that was well-received. And I like biographies. I wrote a biography of Henry Thoreau in 2011, specifically about one aspect of Thoreau's life, his land surveying work. So Maltz and Gold had a major showdown in the 1940s about some aspects of leftist policy. And it was not Gold's best moment, but Albert Maltz came out of it also scarred. They had a disagreement about, you know, how much leftist art should be dictated by politics and how much leftist art should be a more open kind of genre where not everything written had to conform outwardly to socialist or communist ideas. So I was intrigued by him and his response to that initially. And then the more I learned about him, the more interesting he became, especially because, you know, Gold suffered from the blacklist, but there's a kind of suffering from the blacklist that Albert Maltz endured that was in a whole different category, I think. He was a very public artist as a member of the Hollywood 10 who knew, again, like these extremely famous people in Hollywood. He went through, a lot of pain. And then even there's something about Albert Maltz that always intrigued me. He was blacklisted in the United States for 20 years. And then in 1969, he writes a novel that has yet to be published called The Eyewitness Report. And we're going to publish it with Alma Books. And Alessandro Gallienzi there is kind of my partner in getting these Maltz novels either published for the first time or republished. And that's in progress. But this Eyewitness Report is a short novel. And you know what it's about? It's about Soviet oppression of its own people in the Soviet Union, the kind of mentally institutionalizing resistance writers and mentally institutionalizing its own protesters. And Maltz noticed that. He noticed what was happening to Solzhenitsyn and how Solzhenitsyn was kicked out of the Russian Writers Union. And he sympathized with Solzhenitsyn and gave Solzhenitsyn all of his Russian royalties, which was a lot of rubles in those days. And he wrote a novel that championed the cause of anti-Soviet resistance and showed what the Soviet Union was doing to its own citizens, even though he had been a longtime socialist and for a while a member of the U.S. Communist Party. So guess what happened? Albert Maltz was blacklisted in the Soviet Union for his support of Solzhenitsyn. So an interesting guy who can claim to be to have been blacklisted by the U.S. and the USSR for his integrity.
Wow, what a story!
One thing about the A Tale of One January, we haven't gotten to the story of the boy and the apple, and I don't mean to spoil the story, but I would want to say something about that. Maltz was always careful when he talked about the novel after it was out and before it was out about that story, which has become a kind of question about the novel's value as a Holocaust narrative. And it's obvious that with Dunja Wasserstrom's personal testimony that is largely adhered to, but also, you know, tweaked in the ways that we've noted. The story of the boy and the apple is a curious example of a Holocaust testimony that's become very important. Rebecca Whitman's research on this and on the Auschwitz trials in Frankfurt in 1964, in which Dunja Wasserstrom participated, notes that this was a really important and key moment in the 1964 Auschwitz trials of Nazi war criminals held in Frankfurt, Germany. And Dunja Wasserstrom was there. Now, before 64, she had told the story of the boy and the apple to Albert Maltz in their personal interviews in Mexico. But of course, Albert Maltz's novel had not been published yet. And in the lead up to the Frankfurt trials, Wasserstrom had been fairly reticent and not very forthcoming about some of the specifics of her experiences.
And do you want to tell us the broad outlines of that story?
Well, it's a brutal, monstrous, and terrifying act by Wilhelm Boger. Dunja Wasserstrom was a translator in Boger's office, and she had been sent out of the building briefly because they were having a conference. And a transport of children from various parts of Poland had arrived. These were children that had been sheltered by Christians in Poland and had been captured. And there was one boy of between 4 and 6 years old, differing accounts of it, but who had a large apple and was rolling the apple on the ground and playing with it. And Boger saw the boy, approached him, said something, and grabbed him by the ankles and dashed his brains out against the wall. And the ending of the story, as Dunja Wasserstrom apparently told it in Frankfurt, was that later that day she saw Boger eating the boy's apple. And it is described as something by Dunja Wasserstrom that it just broke something inside of her. She never wanted to have children again. She couldn't look at children without, you know, extreme anxiety and trauma for the rest of her life. It stuck with her. In Maltz's, and this is told at the Auschwitz trials, or Frankfurt Auschwitz trials in 64, and it creates kind of a sensation. It is viewed as a kind of an important part of the historical imagination of Auschwitz. But Maltz's novel comes out in 66, 67, and his version of the story of the boy and the apple is slightly different. The slight difference in it, I've discussed it with my students in my classes, and I've thought about it quite a bit myself. Arguably, Maltz's version adds a layer of monstrosity to it. It makes Boger's brutality, I think, even more intense and psychologically complex. But Albert Maltz told that story in his notes his way, and he told it in his novel his way. And in 1979, he was giving an interview to Joel Gardner, an oral history interview, you know, that was kind of summing up his career. And he did a lot of research before these series of interviews with Joel Gardner, and he told it the same way three times. And it's not very different, but it's slightly different, but in a key way from the one accepted at the Auschwitz trials. But the one at the Auschwitz trials was not recorded. It had to be pieced together from secondary sources. And it was also used in Peter Weiss's 1965 play called The Investigation. So you know where I'm leading with this. I don't know which version is the absolute final and complete one, but Albert Maltz stuck to his version, although he acknowledged, because his publisher brought it to his attention, he said, the story of the boy and the apple sounds like something that has already been told. And he said, well, I wrote it first, though. I just couldn't publish it first. So he felt the need to make a note of that with his publisher. And every time he talked about the book, he mentioned that. So to me, that's another feature of the novel that deserves a little attention and discussion.
And thank you for doing that. It really is, I mean, it's a short novel, very powerful, really vivid, I think partly because so much of it is in dialogue that you feel like you're right in the room. And I want to thank you so much, Patrick Chura, for bringing this novel to American readers, finally after many decades. And I look forward to talking with you about your biography of Albert Maltz and also about your publication of, what was the name, the title of the novel that's coming out?
This is A Long Day and a Short Life. It'll be out next month.
Fantastic. Well, make sure that you come back on the show then. Be in touch with us.
Certainly. Thanks very much. I've enjoyed it.
Next up, the unfolding catastrophe in Gaza has us reaching into our archives for context. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The October 7th Hamas attacks on Israeli citizens were utterly horrific. But they cannot be understood without considering their backstory, 75 years of dispossession of the land Palestinians called home for centuries. Now the world is watching in horror as Israel carries out the collective punishment of an entire people that threatens ethnic cleansing at best and genocide at worst. Most of Norman Finkelstein's 10 books have centered on Israeli policy toward the Palestinian people. He's been a fierce critic of that policy, well before others had the courage or even awareness to speak out against it. We spoke with him in 2018 about his book, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. Here's a slightly shortened version of our conversation. Norman Finkelstein, welcome to Writer's Voice. Your book, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom, is really a remarkable dive deep into the humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. It's been described as an open-air prison, the Strip. It's among the most densely populated places in the world. More than two-thirds of its inhabitants are refugees, more than half under 18 years of age. Tell us just briefly, what are the current conditions in which the Palestinians in Gaza are living before we go into some of the history of how this came about?
Well, Gaza has been under an Israeli siege blockade in its current phase since January 2006, after Hamas, the Islamic organization, won parliamentary elections. And this brutal and illegal blockade, because it constitutes a form of collective punishment, its effects were exacerbated by Israel's successive military assaults on Gaza, the three main ones being Operation Cast Lead in December 2008 through January 2009, Operation Pillar of Defense, November 2012, and then Operation Cast Lead, July-August 2014. After each of these really devastating military assaults, Gaza was not able to rebuild because of the blockade. So now you have the effects of an illegal, inhuman blockade compounded by periodic military assaults, which have caused monumental death and destruction, from which Gaza is unable to rebuild after each of the assaults. And now we've reached the point of the bitter fruit of this inhuman and criminal Israeli policy. So human rights organizations and international relief organizations and Israel itself are now saying that Gaza is on the verge of imploding, that Gaza is on the verge, if not already crossed the point, of being unlivable. So, for example, 95% of Gaza's drinking water is contaminated and unfit for human consumption. So on a daily basis, each time a child in Gaza, the 1 million children who are caged in Gaza drinks a glass of water, he or she is poisoning themselves.
These are terrible conditions. And you write in this book, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom, that the book isn't so much about Gaza, but about what has been done to it, some of which you've begun to describe here. You say that Gaza is about a big lie composed of a thousand little lies. What is that big lie?
Well, the big lie is, first of all, that Gaza is the aggressor in the periodic conflicts that erupt between the periodic armed conflicts that erupt between Israel and Gaza. And number two, that Gaza constitutes a threat, let alone an existential threat to Israel. The facts are, number one, and speaking broadly, all the conflicts, armed conflicts, between Israel and Gaza were initiated by Israel. And number two, Gaza poses no military threat to Israel. It doesn't even have any weapons to speak of. All of these claims are contrived by Israel and then repeated obediently by a compliant and complicit mainstream media. But the whole premise is completely preposterous, that Israel in these targeted assassinations is reacting to a threat. The only threat that the Palestinians have posed has been the threat to resolve the conflict, which is what the Israeli political scientist Avner Yaniv called the Palestinian peace offensive. Every time the Palestinians threaten to resolve the conflict peacefully and diplomatically, Israel panics because it fears international pressure will be brought to bear on it to solve the conflict. And Israel doesn't want to solve the conflict because the only basis for solving it would have to be an Israeli withdrawal, which they don't accept. So they periodically launch these offensives, as they did in the case that Avner Yaniv was referring to. In June 1982, they attacked Lebanon not because of a threat, let alone an existential threat posed by Israel, but because the Palestinians, its leadership, had made clear that it supports a two-state settlement on the 1967 borders. And that was, as Avner Yaniv called it, another one of those dreadful Palestinian peace offensives. The idea that Israel is doing these things in self-defense is one of those ludicrous claims which are very popular on the Upper East Side, but in the real world have no connection with reality.
You mentioned the Palestinian drive towards peace, and in 1993 and then in 1995, the Oslo Accords were brokered between Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin. You know, the frame that I've heard over and over from other members of my family, and I'm Jewish, and from other fellow Jews, is that it was the Palestinians who sabotaged the Oslo Accords. I wonder if you could address that.
Well, first of all, the Oslo Accords were not sabotaged. The Oslo Accords achieved their goal. The Oslo Accords were remarkably successful, and one has to credit Israel with having anticipated and predicted with, I would say, impressive insight how the Oslo Accords would unfold. So the background to the Oslo Accords was the First Intifada that began in December 7th, 1987. The First Intifada was a public relations debacle for Israel, as international opinion was outraged at Israel's brutal assault on the Palestinian nonviolent resistance. At that point, Yitzhak Rabin, he was defense minister, but later became prime minister. During the Intifada, he was the one that ordered what was called the force, might, and beatings policy, which was to beat up the Palestinian children to break their bones, as he put it. He said this was a humane policy because we were not killing them, the children. We were just breaking their bones. And then after this first Intifada, the Israeli leadership reached the conclusion that it would no longer be able to maintain the occupation in the current manner. First of all, it was very bad public relations for Israel to be seen beating up little children, throwing stones. And secondly, the army, which was designed for wars, was now bogged down in the West Bank, engaging in civil actions that was worthy more of a police force. So the Israeli leadership, in particular Rabin, decided to rationalize the occupation by replacing the Israeli occupation forces with a domestic or indigenous security force. And the security force they recruited, they hired in order to do the dirty work, which had sullied their name. They hired the PLO to do the dirty work. And the truth be told, it worked perfectly. The Palestinian leadership got all these what are called VIP privileges. They got all sorts of bribes, which they put away into their Swiss bank accounts. And the Palestinian security forces were trained by Jordan and the CIA. And now they're a very efficient totalitarian police force repressing the Palestinians. And now Israel's name has been cleansed, because all of the torture, all of the beatings, all of the killings are done by and large by the Palestinian security forces. And so seen from the vantage point of what Israel's goal was, namely to rationalize the occupation so that the dirty work is now done by an indigenous force, and the army can go about its job, which is to train for future wars, not chase little children down the Kasbah in Nablus. From the vantage point of Israel, Oslo was a huge success.
You mentioned the PLO. In, let's see, 2006, Hamas came into power in a democratically held election. I wonder if you could talk about the PLO and Hamas, and then I'm going to ask you about the Israeli response to that democratic election of Hamas.
Well, the Palestinian people had tired of the corruption and the false promises of the PLO, and so not so much because they embraced Hamas ideology, but more as a protest vote. And also because at that point, Hamas was relatively not corrupt. They elected Hamas into office in January 2006 in what was then the first democratic election in the Arab world, and which was certified as democratic, among others, by Jimmy Carter, who was present at the occasion. Oh, and at that point, the PLO, the Palestinian Authority, like every Arab dictatorship, once it gets into power, doesn't want to leave power and has this sense of entitlement. And so they didn't want to relinquish power. And then they colluded with the U.S. administration and Israel to overthrow Hamas. And in 2007, Hamas foiled the coup attempt and sent the PA packing back to the West Bank.
Mm. Well, so that was in 2007. In 2008, Israel began Operation Cast Lead, which you mentioned before. And you say that aside from deterrence, which is what the Israelis claimed it was for, and maybe you can explain that term, you say it was to fend off, quote, Palestinian pragmatism. So what were the reasons why Israel began Operation Cast Lead? What was the deterrence and what was that pragmatism on the part of the Palestinians?
Well, I've already discussed the pragmatism, the fact that the Palestinians periodically embrace the two-state settlement, which always poses a problem and evokes dread in Israel because it fears that if Palestinians openly embrace the two-state settlement, diplomatic pressure will be put on Israel to also embrace it and withdraw from the territories it illegally occupies, namely the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza. The other main factor in the Israeli assaults has been after Israel suffered a major defeat in Lebanon in 2006, the Israelis feared that the Arabs would no longer feel threatened by Israel. And so it had to restore what it calls its deterrence capacity. And deterrence capacity is just a fancy technical term for the Arab world's fear of us, us meaning Israel. Now, Israel did not want to tangle again with the Hezbollah as it did in Lebanon in 2006. So it looked around for an easy target to show the Arab world that the Israeli killing machine was still well-greased and well-capable of inflicting massive death and destruction. And so it chose Gaza to teach Hezbollah a lesson. It chose to murder and destroy in Gaza in order to restore its deterrence capacity in the Arab world.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Norman Finkelstein about his new book, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. So what about the notion of blame on both sides? I mean, there certainly have been suicide bombers. There has been terrorism on the part of, Palestinians. There have been rockets that have been fired.
Well, let's take your last example. So you say blaming both sides. Let's see. During Operation Protective Edge, 550 Palestinian children were killed. One Israeli child was killed, ratio 550-1. 18,000 Palestinian homes were destroyed. One Israeli home was destroyed, ratio 18,000-1. And now your listeners will have to decide for themselves whether, given that balance sheet, whether the expression both sides suffered accurately depicts what transpired during Operation Protective Edge. Now let's look at these rockets, as they're called. Hamas fired 5,000 rockets and 2,000 mortar shells, altogether 7,000 projectiles at Israel. Of those 5,000 rockets, as they're called, one Israeli home was destroyed. One. So now you have, so to speak, a conundrum. How could it be that 5,000 rockets only managed to destroy one home? That doesn't sound very credible, believable. If I were shooting 5,000 rockets, knowing nothing about rockets, and even if the rockets were lacking in a guidance system, you would think 5,000 rockets, even if fired by somebody as inept as myself, would destroy more than one home. Well, Israel's answer, of course, is Iron Dome. It claims to have a very sophisticated anti-missile defense system. But by Israel's own admission, Iron Dome was only deployed around the major cities, and altogether, Iron Dome was targeted, or only 820 of the Hamas rockets came within the vicinity of Iron Dome. Israel claims Iron Dome deflected 740 of those rockets. The anti-missile specialist at MIT, Theodore Postol, says the figure was probably closer to 40, not 740. But even if we accept the Israeli figure of 740, we're still left with the perplexing situation that at least 4,260 rockets entered Israel and only one house was destroyed. How could that be? Well, the answer is pretty obvious, because those are not rockets. They're just enhanced fireworks. There was no Hamas rockets, just as there were no Hamas terror tunnels, just as there was, if you believe the anti-missile specialist at MIT, Theodore Postol, there was no Iron Dome. These are all just media fictions, which are dutifully repeated not just by Israel's defenders, but by Israel's critics, because unbeknownst to themselves, they're just repeating Israeli propaganda.
That was Norman Finkelstein talking with us in 2018 about his book, Gaza. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.